This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Over the weekend, President Trump said the U.S. would designate Antifa as a domestic terrorist group. But what is it? Who are its members and what do they want? We're learning more about the movement coming up. And also, join us tomorrow night at 8 on the Ideas Network for Call to Mind, a spotlight on Black trauma and policing. It's a conversation about how racial and cultural trauma affect Black Americans and others, and what support, treatments, and preventative measures are needed. Listen and learn with us tomorrow night at 8 o'clock. Now, UW System President Ray Cross is asking for a special session in the legislature as the system deals with the effects of the coronavirus. Cross wants to be able to borrow money to handle cash flow issues, and he wants the power to change the school start date next year. On top of that, UW has announced one finalist in their search to replace Cross, a candidate who's getting some pushback. And a note for listeners in this conversation, WPR is a service of UW-Madison. Rich Kramer is a reporter for WPR based in Eau Claire. He's been reporting on both of the stories we're talking about. Rich, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Keely.
Ray Cross released this letter today. Can you break down what he's asking from the legislature and from Governor Tony Evers?
He's essentially asking for some changes in state law, specifically, and this is something that he talked about recently to the press when he was discussing the challenges, financial challenges from COVID-19. But he mentioned that University of Wisconsin system doesn't have the authority to seek lines of credit or essentially borrow money and without any state support. And so what he's asking for here is a change in state law that would allow UW system to open a line of credit. And he's not saying that they absolutely need this, but he said there's a lot of speculation that state revenue projections are way down or will be, and then state lawmakers are going to have to find places to cut. And after what the University of Wisconsin system has already gone through, an estimated, you know, $212 million in revenue losses due to COVID-19, they're just expecting more cuts to come down the pipeline. So this specifically would let the UW kind of hedge against that by borrowing money. And the other changes that he's recommending are required, they're in state law as well, but right now the UW system has to file a lot of reports about finances and other things with the State Department of Administration and just a bunch of other boards, the Joint Finance Committee, et cetera. And Cross is saying that he's got staff that work on that, that they could be used in other places or for other reasons right now. So that would free up some resources. And then the other thing is President Cross wants to try to get the fall semester, which generally starts September 1st, and it's required to start on September 1st in state law. He wants that to be changed in statute so that they can move up the school year, basically. And he said, ideally, he'd like to have the fall semester end before Thanksgiving, which is a big change.
And that would be, I presume, because of concerns of, a second wave of COVID-19. Yeah. and the fact that regular other viruses get bad in the wintertime. So there's potential this one would, too. Is that fair?
Absolutely. I asked him that today. I talked with President Cross, and I said, is this based on CDC requirements? He said, no, but there's just this understanding that there could be a second wave in the later fall. And he said that, given what they went through, having to move all the classes online within a week or two time frame was really jarring for students and faculty and staff, everybody. So to move it up, it seems like they're trying to hedge their bets for that possibility that the virus will come back this fall.
We have, circling back to the issue of borrowing, we've seen lawmakers and Governor Evers go back and forth when dealing with budgets. What kind of a response have we seen from legislative leaders or the governor's office hearing Ray Cross say, the university system should be able to borrow money, let us?
Right. I expected some pushback, actually, from the Republican lawmakers, Assembly Speaker Voss and Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald. But all they've said right now, and this is all via statement, is that they're going to discuss the requests with their constituents or with the caucuses. So, and I haven't seen anything from Governor Evers' office. So the way I understand it, Governor Evers would have to call the special session. And then for any of this to pass, they'd need the support of, you know, Fitzgerald and Voss in the different chambers. So it's a big question mark. And it seems like, because Republicans in particular and the leaders, they've been very critical about UW spending. And this goes back to 2013 when there was a report that showed the university had hundreds of millions of dollars in cash reserves from tuition, what are called tuition fund balances. That angered a lot of people, and that's what kind of triggered the tuition freeze. So for 7 years now at four-year universities, campuses have not been allowed to increase tuition for in-state resident students. So it's to be determined how the legislature will react to this. I really haven't seen much response other than we're going to talk about it.
We're talking with Rich Kramer, who's a reporter for WPR based in Eau Claire and covers higher education. And Rich, I want to turn to the search to replace Ray Cross because he is leaving as UW president. And the search so far has turned up one finalist when it comes to Ray Cross's job. What do we know about Jim Johnson?
Jim Johnson is currently the president of the University of Alaska system. He's been there since 2015, and University of Alaska system, not unlike the UW system in Wisconsin, they've been going through a lot of issues with financial troubles. They've had declining enrollment, they've had declining state support, and Jim Johnson has kind of overseen the restructuring up there. They're talking about moving campuses. You know, there was discussion of closing one part of a campus and then kind of moving them together, kind of like what happened in 2017, 2018 with the UW restructure, merging some campuses together. But also one of the things that kind of struck out to me is there was a report from Alaskan Public Media that said that just last week, Johnson was talking about options, you know, for how to address these financial troubles. One of them was to cut 50 degree programs. And that seems similar to what has been proposed by President Cross. He put out this document called the Blueprint, Blueprint for the University of Wisconsin System Beyond COVID-19. And it kind of lays out not hard recommendations, but just requests that to eliminate the degree programs, basically to get rid of duplicate major degree programs that are duplicated across the state's comprehensive universities. Comprehensive university is code for all campuses other than UW-Madison and UW-Milwaukee, the two research institutions. So there's a lot of similarities there. And to me, it was very strange that the search committee, which has been criticized from the beginning because it didn't include any students, faculty, or staff from the campuses, that they had one single finalist. The release that came out from the UW system said that there was a large pool of candidates, but that at the last minute, some of the finalists decided to pull out because they didn't want their names to be publicized as finalists during the pandemic, which seems strange. So I asked for some clarification on that, but the UW system, the regents, declined to comment so far.
And Rich, we just have a minute left, but I do want to mention that you're right, the search process has been criticized, but there's also some concern about the candidate that's been floated. He comes with a bit of a reputation from some faculty and students in Alaska.
Yeah. It sounds, the concerns that the faculty up there have mentioned, at least what I've read in the press, do seem similar to some of the concerns that people have had with President Cross, you know, some of the faculty at the campuses, that it's a top-down approach, very much like a manager, not a lot of input from, you know, that Jim Johnson doesn't seek input from shared governance, and that's, you know, faculty senate, student senate, et cetera. So, but this is kind of what it seems to be a trend across a lot of higher education is that the administrators are trying to run these institutions like businesses, which is a bit of a shift from before, where you know, any changes really had to go through a long process and get wide agreement from a number of players on campus. So it just seems to be kind of going down that route of more of a business-like approach.
All right, Rich, we know that there's some talk of faculty preparing to lobby to remove him, and it's a really complicated story. And so thank you for catching us up so far, and we'll certainly keep watching it. We appreciate your time, Rich.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate being on.
That was Rich Kramer, WPR's reporter based in Eau Claire. And coming up, we'll find out how one group of Wisconsin third graders is feeling about finishing up their school year at home. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina. Coming up, we're learning about the group Antifa, what it is, what it isn't, and what its members play, what role its members play in demonstrations this last week. Right now, though, time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a conversation with some third graders about the end of their school year.
School is ending for many Wisconsin students this week. In an extraordinary year, many had to adjust to online learning.
And good morning to you all. Happy Wednesday. This is the last day I'm going to see you this week.
That includes the third graders at Madison Country Day School and their teacher, Galen Wheezy. I talked with a few of his students over the computer, and they filled me in on what it was like to suddenly go to school online.
I actually kind of like it. I've always wanted to be homeschooled because we live like a half an hour away from school, and now we get another hour of sleep. Hi, my name's Bria. And I'm in third grade, Mr. Wheezy's class. Sometimes when I need help, like before I just needed my dad's help, but he is usually on call, so I had to kind of wait or figure it out myself.
Hi, my name is Gia, and I'm in third grade, Mr. Wheezy's class. Well, I have a few goods and bads, but a good is that through here, it doesn't take too long for me to get done with my work. Because I can literally just press on the link and then get my assignments instead of searching through my desk and walking to the classroom. I feel like it's kind of a little harder to focus, and sometimes when I'm really bored, I even see faces on the walls and rooms, and I'm like, oh, hi there, door.
Hi, my name's Anthea, and I'm in third grade in Mr. Reese's class. I guess it's been a little bit busier than normal because my dad and my mom are in meetings, like 24/7 almost.
Gia, Adia, and Bria each have parents who are working from home, at an office, or at a hospital. Mr. Wheezy says most of his students have supportive families and are going through similar situations.
I am proud of them because most of my students have two working parents and they are having to do it on their own. Like learn through my lessons, but like troubleshoot the technological issues on their own and like be on top of their own learning.
Something that I think I've gotten to work on more is in kindergarten, when time was first brought up. Ever since then, I've never really understood time, I guess. I'm not sure why. It just didn't make sense in my brain. But now I feel like from homeschooling and doing it more by myself, now I'm kind of getting the hang of time.
I have a box where I have like random states and countries. And what I try to do is I pick one slip out and it would name a country. Then I try to do some research on that country and learn things about it.
Beyond schoolwork, Adia, Gia, and Bria say they've learned a lot about themselves and their families during this time. They've even achieved some major milestones.
Well, I'm getting active outside a lot more. I'm getting on my bike rides a lot more. Because of the coronavirus lockdown, I got off my training wheels. So that's good.
After Corona, which could be in a long time, but I think I'd be a little more independent. I learned how to do the dishes. I start help cooking. I make the desserts. I do like so much more.
What I help out with the desserts is eating them and eating the food.
I've been trying to take care of my sister whenever I can while my parents have meetings. She just turned 3 at the end of April. After I finish my homework, I just go downstairs, and if she's watching TV, I leave her alone. But if she's spilling toys all over the place, I try to act firm, but most of the times, I end up laughing because she always does something funny to cheer me, my mom, or my dad up.
Another thing that I learned about my family is whenever I came home from school, I'd always bug my parents because I wanted something. But now that I'm at home, I kind of see what they are actually doing during the day. So that's probably why they'd always be cranky when I get home, and then I kind of bother them even more. Well, now I see why they're cranky, and now I think I'm going to be more careful about that.
While the third graders are learning a lot about themselves and enjoying their time at home, there is one thing they really miss.
Friends. Mm-hmm. All my friends. We still get to chat on video calls, but it's still not like meeting them in person. Whenever we video call, it somehow reminds me that we're far away from each other. If we're actually meeting in person, it makes me feel warm, a warm, fuzzy feeling.
Mm-hmm. It gives you a really, like what Adia said, a real warm, fuzzy feeling when you go on a long break and then you just see your best friend standing in the doorway when you come back to school. It's really nice.
Yeah, I actually think about my friends every day. I'm like, oh, I wonder what my friend is doing.
So when everything is safe, what are the first things that you want to do with your friends?
Sleepover.
Oh, yeah.
And so first of all, we'd have pillow fights, then mess up all the couches, then eat popcorn, then have movies, then sneak in some chocolate wafers, then brush our teeth together, then eat.
We'd play hide and seek in the basement. We probably have a pillow fight because I'm going to give you a little hint why. I've never had a pillow fight in my life.
Pillow fights aside, Adia and Mr. Wheezy both had some final thoughts they wanted to share.
I think at the beginning, I was all like, oh my goodness, what's going to happen? I'm so scared. But then I kind of learned to calm down instead of freaking out like it was before. I thought the world has gone through all these things before, and viruses and sicknesses haven't beaten humankind yet. So we can probably do it again.
As an educator, I really want to reassure parents that their child is learning a ton of stuff during this time. Even if they're not even doing the lessons that I've provided, just living through this time, having to help out with your family, learning how to communicate via the internet, learning how to be more self-reliant when there isn't a parent to be able to help them all the time. Like, those skills alone are immeasurable.
That was Galen Wheezy, a teacher at Madison Country Day School, along with his third grade students, Adia, Bria, and Gia. They were reflecting on ending the school year from home. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum. Now, Galen Wheezy is live to talk with us about how his third graders handled this strange school year. And goodness, Galen, you got some inspiration in that classroom.
Definitely. Thank you for having me on today.
Yeah, certainly. Was this attitude pretty typical of classmates? Sad that they are missing their fellow classmates, but also excited to see each other on video?
I think absolutely. I was amazed at, the first day back after we knew that we needed to be learning from home. They were so excited to see each other on video conference. And, it was like the first day of school again, seeing all their old friends via online. And I think, they're all missing each other's company in person, but really, I felt like made the best of the situation.
How about you, though, as an educator, how did you adjust to the fact not only that you have to deal with the curriculum with students from home, but also that the kids are distracted more, they're being expected to help out more at home? How did you handle that as an educator?
It was definitely a quick learning curve in how to learn a lot of new tools to use. And I have to say, my administration did a fantastic job of the way our spring break lined up and using some professional development days to not only make sure that all of us were prepared as teachers, but also to really front load and prepare the families and students. So, it was a little scary at first, but again, that first Zoom meeting that I had with my kids brought me back to, why I love teaching, and I knew that we'd be able to get through it. It's definitely different, definitely a different time, and we had to make a lot of adjustments, but overall, a fantastic time.
You knew that you could get through it because of the kids.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to put it. They showed a lot of independence in their ability to troubleshoot issues as they came along, and an excitement to learn in a different way. That's, I think, one of the odd silver linings was that this change in venue, I think, rejuvenated some of them into the curriculum, and it meant that I had to reinvent the curriculum in a lot of different ways, which made it fun and exciting.
Sure. And they learned it in ways they probably didn't expect to. What do you think? Will this experience ultimately be good for this group of third graders?
I think so. I really do. The crash course that they had to take in learning how to use online documents and being able to share documents with each other and communicate with me, whether it was through email or video conferencing, and doing all of that, yes, with the support of their teachers and their family, but having to navigate a lot of that independently, that's a skill that will continue to pay dividends all through their schooling career.
Yeah, absolutely. Galen, thank you so much for sharing your experience with us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Galen Wheezy is the third grade teacher at Madison Country Day School. We heard from him and some of his students about what it's like to finish up the school year during the COVID-19 pandemic. I'm Keely Boltina. You're listening to Central Time, and this is the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow after 7 on the morning show, children seem to have a lower risk of contracting a COVID-19 infection. They also seem to usually carry the virus without having symptoms. But a rare and sometimes fatal illness is related to the coronavirus in kids, and Wisconsin has a handful of suspected cases. We talk with two pediatric doctors about it tomorrow morning here on the Ideas Network. Now, over the weekend, President Trump tweeted that the U.S. would be designating Antifa as a terrorist organization. The move came after riots and looting broke out in American cities amid the protests over the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis police custody. Some people question Trump's terrorist label, saying the U.S. has no domestic terrorism law. They also noted that Antifa is not a formal organization with official members or a recognized leader. Antifa is short for anti-fascist. And we're trying to figure out who they are, what their goals are, their methods, and the amount of influence they have on society. That's where Mark Bray comes in. He's a history lecturer at Rutgers University, also wrote Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook. Mark, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Antifa has gained prominence in recent years, but the idea actually started decades ago. How did this get off the ground?
Sure. So, I mean, the long history of anti-fascism stretches back a century to those who resisted Hitler and Mussolini and so forth. But the term Antifa, as we know it, refers to a more recent tradition that emerged in Europe after World War II and made its way across the ocean to the United States starting in the 80s and 90s, of a kind of militant anti-fascism that seeks to stop the growth of the far right through direct action, through popular community organization and mobilization, rather than relying on laws or the police. And it groups together all sorts of different radicals, socialists, anarchists, and so forth. Americans really had no idea what it was, though, until the start of 2017 in the context of the new Trump administration, the growth of the alt-right, and confrontations with far-right figures and groups in Berkeley, Charlottesville, and elsewhere. And the media profile of Antifa declined until President Trump pulled the anti-fascist rabbit out of the hat in order to distract people's attention away from, you know, the biggest rebellion going on in this country that we've seen for 50 years.
Yeah, we heard this more around the events in Charlottesville a couple of years ago, and now it seems like suddenly it's back to part of our conversation.
Right. I mean, for me, it's pretty self-evident that Trump doesn't want to talk about the really difficult conversations around why it is that our cities are on fire and black people keep getting murdered by the police.
And we should address the fact, I mean, I'm saying Antifa, as I've heard it, you're calling it Antifa. Do we know, I mean, what's the right way? How do we get our arms even around pronouncing this organization as we try to figure out who's part of it, even though it's not really an organization? You see where I'm going here.
Yeah, I mean, I don't get caught up in pronunciation. Europeans that I've met tend to say Antifa. Americans that pronounce it Antifa. You know, I don't get into the pronunciation game. But as you mentioned in the outset, though, it's not one uniform organization. It's a kind of politics. It's a kind of activity of revolutionary opposition to the far right. So in that sense, there are specific Antifa organizations around the country. In New York, in Portland, Oregon, in California, elsewhere. I don't know about Wisconsin offhand, but sometimes they collaborate, sometimes they don't. But they're generally autonomous, decentralized, and non-hierarchical. So it's really misrepresenting what it is to try and lump it under the umbrella of this uniform organizational label. But I think that confusion works in the interest of Trump and his allies in trying to demonize this kind of resistance to the far right.
Right. It's harder to describe. It's harder to get your arms around.
Indeed. And therefore, it makes a more convincing boogeyman. Right. Because the general impression that people have is, OK, these are, you know, people dressed in black who break things and are thought, since we don't know who they are, necessarily to always be from somewhere else, even though, you know, everyone's from somewhere or lives somewhere. And in that way, it's a way to not talk about the really difficult questions of, you know, why do people feel like the criminal justice system isn't reforming despite all this death, and that people need to take to the streets and in some cases even commit property destruction in order to make their point.
We're talking with Mark Bray, who's a history lecturer at Rutgers University, also wrote the book Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. And Charlie from Milwaukee is on the line. Hey, Charlie.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I guess the part that concerns me about the Antifa movement is that selective interpretation or the selective enforcement of the laws allows anyone to selectively interpret which laws they want. The far right or someone could say, I believe that gun control laws are illegal, and they can then all the time carry around guns and break the law that way. We are a nation of laws. We need to have all of our laws, whether we like them or not, you know, enforced and kept, and avoid the looting and the rioting and everything else. We need to respect all the laws and other people's interpretations and political views.
So, Charlie, are you concerned Antifa is members of Antifa are violent, or that they don't respect laws? What's your biggest concern there?
My biggest concern is that they do engage in violence, but they also have an interpretation that says, if you don't agree with me, I'm going to call you a nasty word, and that you are then susceptible to violence. I think it's wrong that people are not allowed to have their views and on both sides.
All right. Yeah, Charlie, thanks for that. And that's why I was wondering what your concerns are and how you interpret Antifa, Charlie, because I'd like to give Mark Bray an opportunity to answer that question of Charlie's interpretation is that Antifa members are violent. Is that true?
Well, also, he raised the interesting question around the question of the law, right? Mm-hmm. And so what this massive and historic moment in American history raises for us is, how much faith do we have in the law? How much faith do we have in the police to do the right thing? And clearly, a lot of Americans, particularly Black Americans, are not as optimistic as Charlie about the ability of the law to safeguard their lives. And that's really the big issue here. And when the law doesn't do what people think it should, that's when you start to see people going outside of the normal routes of addressing grievances and protesting, and when you start seeing things being broken. I mean, the history of property destruction shows us that. The Boston Tea Party or the suffragettes of the early 20th century who broke windows because no one was listening to their grievances because it was against the law for them to be able to vote. So the history of social transformation is the limitations of the law and people butting up against them. And, you know, unfortunately, that's often rather messy if you look at the history.
So on the question, though, that some people are concerned that Antifa is commonly associated with violence or vandalism, how much truth is there to that?
Well, certainly the moments that people know best about anti-fascists out in the public have involved property destruction or confrontation. I mean, take Berkeley in early 2017 when anti-fascists disrupted a planned event by the far-right provocateur Milo Yiannopoulos. After petitioning the school to shut down the event because Yiannopoulos had previously outed transgender students and incited hatred against undocumented students, the university wouldn't shut down. The anti-fascists broke windows to shut down the event. It was effective, even if you disagree with the methods. In Charlottesville, that was a bit more dramatic and a bit more polarizing, right? You had figures like Cornel West and other clergy claiming that the Antifa defended them from the armed white supremacists as they were charging. So certainly there's no question that tactics of what people often refer to as violent tactics are part of the anti-fascist playbook. But most of what they do really involves researching who far-right groups are, tracking down their identities, informing their employers or their universities, and making it so that Nazis and white supremacists don't find safe haven in our communities. And really, if we act upon that information and make it taboo to be a white supremacist, then the need for confronting large groups of people dissipates. In this context, there actually, according to a leaked FBI report published in The Nation, isn't actually any evidence of any organized Antifa participation in any of this. I mean, it's quite plausible that there are members of groups out in the streets, right? These are people that care about anti-racism and care about justice for the victims of police murder, but it's really not particularly germane to this beyond what President Trump had to say.
And if Antifa is not this big official group, then what actually makes somebody a part of Antifa?
Well, the better question is what makes someone part of a specific Antifa group, right?
Okay.
So if you create a group or you make a group and you organize against the far right, congratulations, you're an Antifa group. Just like if you want to create a bird watching group, you get your friends together, you go watch birds. You're a bird watching group, right? There is no formal membership at writ at large, but if you make a group, you can have formal membership. So in that way, there are groups that were created over the past decade, but primarily from 2016, 2017, around the country in Rochester, New York, in Atlanta, etc. And these are relatively small groups of people because they're concerned about infiltration from law enforcement or the far right. And that keeps their numbers so low that they don't really have the kind of mobilizing capacity that would be necessary to, you know, initiate the kind of rebellion we've seen.
Hmm. So you're kind of using Antifa as an adjective, whereas we've been talking about it as if it's a noun, as if it's a thing. And you're saying it's a way to describe certain kinds of groups.
Right. And not all groups that do this kind of work call themselves Antifa. I mean, there have been interesting conversations within the movement about, you know, you could just call yourself Anti-Racist Coalition and do a lot of the same work and it wouldn't have the same kind of stigma. You know, that's just sort of the politics of it. Yeah.
All right. We're talking all about Antifa with Mark Bray. He's a history lecturer at Rutgers University and the author of Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook. You can join us at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about Antifa, how we talk about it, origins, tactics, influences, so on? Do you have a favorable or unfavorable impression? And why is that? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. You can also tweet us at Central Time WP. This conversation continues in just a bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina, and we're talking about Antifa with Rutgers University history lecturer Mark Bray. He's also the author of Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook. In a tweet on Sunday, President Trump deemed Antifa a domestic terror organization, putting a renewed focus on this movement. And you can call in with your questions and comments at 800-642-1234. Are you sympathetic toward organizations that call themselves Antifa, or are you concerned that that it has a role in violence in U.S. cities. Let's have our guest explain to us, help us better understand his research into what Antifa really is. We've got Dan from Superior on the line who's ready to talk with us. Dan, what's on your mind?
Yeah, hi. I was listening to this gentleman talk about Antifa, and from my experience, I don't see Antifa as being some freedom-fighting group. I think they're terrorists. And the way I see it is, what gives this so-called Antifa group the right to label anybody else that they disagree with as far-right or fascist or whatever you want to call it? I mean, the gall of that is just amazing. And they're all wearing masks, most of them, because they know dang well they're doing illegal stuff. And, you know, they've also assaulted people. They put people in the hospital. So I guess my question is, you know, he wants to talk about the far right or whatever that is. Maybe we should be talking about the far left and communists, because clearly that's what they are. And, you know, and I'm actually kind of shocked it's public radio, but I'm actually glad that you did this. I'm glad that you brought people like this on so we can hear their views.
Yeah, Dan, we're trying to make sure that we advance all sides to help us understand what's happening in our nation right now. Dan is concerned that, Mark Bray, that Antifa is communism. And that's my understanding is that's not what Antifa organizers believe in. Is that true?
Dan sounds like my Twitter mentions. I think the ultimate issue in terms of like who gets to decide is really kind of a profound question, because it's kind of a contestation over sovereignty, right? We're accustomed to believe that the state and the laws, just as the earlier caller said, are naturally the bottom line in terms of justice. This kind of social movement that we're witnessing calls that into question when there's injustice. So does the history of fascism. Right. When Hitler gained power and when Mussolini gained power, they did so essentially legally. And then Hitler orchestrated a genocide, which, of course, by virtue of changing the laws of the state, became largely legal. And so the point that this all raises, regardless of what your politics are, is justice and the law do not always dovetail. And so when you have people organizing to try and change the laws or to try and work with the laws to demonize and incite violence against marginalized people, and you consider that the police are not up to the task of shutting this down always, the question is, what do you do? And that's where Antifa comes in terms of people who believe that actually, historically, the police force is complicit in the development of white supremacy and that they're essentially frequently killing black people, as we've seen. You know, sometimes you need to step outside of the bounds of normal protest in order to actually do something that's just. But as far as the question of them being communists, like, these are anarchists and communists and socialists, people who do want to create a post-capitalist society. So they are radicals, and that dictates how they go about doing what they're doing. They don't actually have respect for the American government.
Mark, what do you think then about the president calling Antifa terrorists when you just said they don't respect the American government?
Well, it's not illegal to have disrespect for the American government. They've never killed anyone, which is more than can be said for many of the far right groups that President Trump has been apologetic for, most notably after Charlottesville, when he said there were good people on both sides. And not to mention the fact that, like, legally, you can't designate them a terrorist organization, domestic terrorist organization, and they're not an organization. So really, to me, it's more of trying to use the most, malicious political slur that we have, I suppose, other than fascist, in order to discredit it.
And do you see Antifa growing in stature in the U.S.?
You see, the thing is, it's not a kind of politics that aspires to be like a mass political movement. It's about largely about small group action, although there are other forms of popular anti-fascism that we've seen in terms of people showing up at big counter demonstrations in Boston and elsewhere. Really, the ebb and flow of anti-fascism has historically had everything to do with the rise and fall of the far right. So it all depends on what the American political landscape looks like. But certainly with Trump threatening to call out the military, although, of course, there's debate about how much he can actually do that, those kinds of moments will dictate what the response will look like.
All right, Mark, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure.
Mark Bray is a history lecturer at Rutgers University and the author of Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook. WPR and Wisconsin Watch are documenting the lives of Wisconsinites in this unprecedented time with a series of audio diaries called Outbreak Wisconsin. During the pandemic, some restaurants have been able to offer curbside or carryout service to ease the loss of sales. That wasn't the case for everyone. Adija Greer-Smith has just opened her bakery, Confectionately Yours, in Milwaukee's Sherman, Phoenix, less than 2 years ago. Then the pandemic hit and closed it for 2 months.
We had just came off of an anniversary back in November. My staff was finally solid, had a good system in place, good rhythm in place. Finally, really kind of learning the ins and outs of operating. The customer base was solid, very supportive. And then like a ton of bricks, everything comes crashing down. So, you know, as time started going, I started saying, you know what? This thing is serious. You can't sweat the small stuff. Then I started saying, okay, well, how am I going to pay rent? And I'm not selling products. Yeah, I've had to call my mortgage company and ask for relief. I've had to call my bank that my car note is with and ask them for relief. But, you know, I'm not the only one. My family has been trying to adjust, but it's been emotional. I got choked up today having to take Xavier, my oldest son, to his school to pick up a yard sign because he was supposed to have his eighth grade graduation this year. And I pull up with him at the school. You know, his teachers are out and they're just happy to see him. He's a student class president and he has to have a virtual graduation. This is not how I planned for my year to go. But what do? We just adjust, we adapt. My grandmother used to always say, you want to make God laugh, tell him your plans. So it's Wednesday and I'm headed to the Sherman Phoenix, headed to the bakery. Normally this would be our day of delivering cookie to healthcare workers. But as we are preparing to reopen and relaunch at the Phoenix, it's time to kind of start getting things together. I kind of have mixed feelings right now, mainly because I'm not really confident that everything that's going on with the COVID is really under control. And I know ultimately it's going to affect my staff and how comfortable they are. It's going to affect, of course, me and my comfort level with being around, you know, the general public on a regular basis. So, I kind of have mixed feelings. As much as I'm excited to get things open again, I'm still honestly apprehensive about how safe it is. I'm going to head in. You know, the mask has become the new normal. So, I'm going to mask up, put my gloves on as I go into the building, sanitize everything before we get started. And just try to start prepping because next week we reopen.
This story is part of Outbreak Wisconsin, which is a new series from WPR and from Wisconsin Watch. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we have a guest who realizes she doesn't want to buy stuff anymore. We're talking about how that epiphany fits in with an economy built on Americans buying. And we're talking about how violence relates to nonviolent protest and how what we're seeing now is part of the pattern of racial discrimination. That's tomorrow on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show. Tomorrow, hear from a Milwaukee alderperson about what it's like in the city as protests continue. Cities across the country, including here in Wisconsin, have erupted in protests and civil unrest in response to the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis. Plus, more people are dying and our traditional ways of honoring people aren't always options. So we're having a conversation about grief in the age of COVID-19. That's tomorrow morning here on the Ideas Network. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR. And then the nonsensical words we call gibberish have a long history, and they might have more meaning than you think. We talk to a linguist about what gibberish can teach us. I'm Keely Boltina. This is Central Time.